President Raisi says Iran will protect the rights of its people to the very end. This as high-stakes diplomacy continues to revive the 2015 deal. Dockers at Britain's biggest port are walking off their jobs as part of an 8-day strike that could paralyze supply chains. Also in this newscast, the Russian journalist and daughter of a well-known political philosopher is killed in a car blast near Moscow. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, Iran saying it will not give up the rights of the nation in any talks or meetings amid a flurry of diplomatic exchanges to revive the 2015 deal, the JCPOA. The president says that his administration will powerfully continue efforts to resolve Iran's problems and push for progress. Ibrahim Raisi promised not to tie the people's livelihoods to any foreign factor. He says Iran has secured a considerable part of its demands from some other countries. The comments were made amid intense speculation about the fate of JCPOA after Tehran provided its written response to the most recent EU proposal to salvage the deal. Tehran says Washington must now show flexibility and take a realistic approach if it really wants a final agreement. Nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims have urged U.S. President Biden to reverse his order and send back billions in Afghanistan's frozen funds. Washington has been keeping the Afghan money despite a deepening economic crisis in Afghanistan. Our correspondent reports from Kabul.
1 year ago, following the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, the U.S. froze about $7 billion in Afghan central bank assets and cut major international funding to the country. The measure, which pushed the Afghan economy to collapse, faced backlash from inside and outside Afghanistan. In February, U.S. President Joe Biden signed an order, splitting Afghan assets between relief aid to Afghanistan and 9/11 victims. On Tuesday, nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims sent a letter to Biden, saying the money belongs to Afghans, urging him to release the money without delay.
In fact, no law, regulation, or moral orders permits a country to freeze the reserves of another country and create a situation where the owners of the money face economic suffering. The money, which is blocked by the U.S. and its allies, belongs to the people of Afghanistan. As I mentioned, based on the international laws and moral norms, the U.S. doesn't have the right to decide on Afghan assets, be it keeping the money or splitting it between 9/11 victims.
In Afghanistan, more and more people are going without job and cash, as the U.S. sanctions have paralyzed the public economy. Frustrated Afghans call for the release of Afghanistan's central bank assets and solidarity from the international community.
The U.S. should solve its disputes with the Taliban. Why is it punishing poor Afghan people? Both sides have had their battle and agreement. Today, the U.S. is stealing that piece of bread of ours which was supposed to fill the stomachs of our children. Why is the U.S. creating this dire situation which everyone is hungry and poor? In addition, we have been the victims of the terrorism and we can't pay the price for 9/11.
Majority of the Afghan population is in need of humanitarian assistance. More than half of Afghans are going hungry, and more than a million children are severely malnourished. The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is getting worse day by day, and the country needs its frozen funds for an economic recovery. It remains to be seen when Washington opens its eyes on the miseries of Afghans and returns their money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Palestinian president slams Israel's forced closure of 7 Palestinian non-government organizations in the occupied West Bank. Mahmoud Abbas says that the regime's unilateral actions are unacceptable and in violation of the international law. He held international consensus condemning the closures, but noted that practical international measures are needed to stop such aggressive policies. The Palestinian president added that the NGOs will continue to expose the Israeli crimes, irrespective of the shutdown order. On Friday, 9 European countries, including France and Germany, said that they were deeply concerned by the move. The United Nations also urged the regime to allow the NGOs to continue working.
Early on Thursday, the Israeli military has shot down 7 Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. The military broke into the offices of the organizations and confiscated property. Palestinians' foreign ministry has censored the raid as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice, saying rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. 6 of the organizations raided had been criminalized as terrorist organizations in October 2021 by Israel, which claimed they were affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless. The organizations targeted on Thursday work in fields such as human rights, prisoner support, children's rights, and healthcare. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations by Israel, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The 7th organization was the Union of Health Work Committees. Since 1967, Israel has banned more than 400 local and international organizations, including all major Palestinian political parties. Analysts speculate that Israel had attacked the groups because they were becoming increasingly effective at exposing Israel's repression of Palestinian people.
That their Achilles heel is their ongoing horrific violations of human rights, which are losing them support throughout the world. And so they're apparently thinking that they can kill the messenger and get rid of those who are reporting on their crimes just by shutting them down on spurious pretenses.
Israeli forces raided, sealed, and imposed closure orders on the offices of 7 prominent Palestinian human rights and social services organizations in the West Bank. Now, Tel Aviv claims that those NGOs have links with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and that's a claim that they reject.
The Israeli army has deprived generations of Palestinians in the West Bank of their basic civil rights, including the right to expression, regularly using military force to suppress Palestinian people. The latest raid on Palestinian non-governmental human rights organizations and their designations as terrorist organizations have been denounced by UN experts and were rejected by 9 European states that fund the targeted groups. The European countries also called Israel's allegations against the NGOs unsubstantiated. Last year, Israel's leading human rights group, Betzalim, said in a report that Israel is not a democracy but an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws, is using laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another.
Israel is obviously trying to silence the voices of critics who've been documenting the ongoing abuses of human rights, the murders of children, shooting down teenagers, bombing targets, and killing all sorts of people, often at random. They're essentially ongoing massacres, not to mention the torture, which is a systematic feature of Israeli policy.
Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories should be scrutinized, but only condemning Israeli raids on Palestinian civil society groups is not enough. It's high time the UN and international organizations took direct action against Israeli atrocities.
The flow of goods grinding to a halt at the UK's largest container port, where dock workers have started their first strike in 30 years over a pay dispute. The walkout involves 1,900 staffers of Felixstowe Port. They are represented by Unite Union, which says that the 8-day action is in response to the port operator's failure to give dock workers a raise proportionate to inflation. Unite says that industrial action will cause huge disruption and send shockwaves through the UK's supply chain. The strike is the latest in a string of similar moves by workers across different sectors, and that amid a cost-of-living crisis in Britain, where consumer price inflation hit 10.1% in July.
Shuttered stations and picket lines. Another day of severe disruption in the British capital.
We're just outside an underground station in West London, usually a very busy station, but today it is closed. The same thing or very limited service across many different stations in London for 24 hours.
It comes a day after another mass walkout of railway workers. The advice from the authorities, avoid traveling on the tube if possible.
I'm with them because it's true, when you're 60, why should you retire? I mean, why should they give you redundancy?
I mean, the cost of living's going up and all that. They're asking for a fair thing. Same in any job. They're offering silly things like 3% when inflation now is 10%. So I'm fully behind them.
I understand the people. That's normal. They are workers. They need more money, of course. Everything is rising.
A major bus walkout will also affect travel in parts of the capital. While a second day of rail strikes is expected to disrupt services around the country on Saturday. Almost all are part of widespread stoppages in recent months organized mainly by the National Union of Railway, Maritime and Transport Workers, locked in a face-off with the government over modernizing changes, wages and pensions, among other things.
People in this country are fed up with low pay. Many millions of people have had not a proper pay deal for a decade. So public sector workers in healthcare, education, transport, all sorts of services have been subjected to pay cuts and rampant inflation.
The ongoing strikes are inspiring other public sector workers, such as nurses and teachers, to do the same in the face of rampant inflation forecast to top 13% this year.
In the next few months, you're bound to see a convergence of trade unions all taking very direct action, calling their members on strike in an effort to protect the cost of living increases and the deterioration of wages that we've seen for workers across the country.
The government has threatened to use emergency powers to block future strikes. The unions, on the other hand, say they're not relenting unless they receive new deals they deem acceptable. Saeed Puriza, London.
The daughter of a controversial Russian political commentator has been killed in a suspected car bomb attack outside Moscow. According to investigators, Daria Dugina, the daughter of Alexander Dugin, was killed when a suspected explosive device detonated on the vehicle she was traveling in. TV footage accompanying the statement shows investigators collecting debris and fragments from the spot of the explosion. Investigators who described Dugina as a journalist and political expert say that they've opened the murder case and will be carrying out forensic examinations to try and determine exactly what happened. Her father is a veteran Russian philosopher known for his staunch anti-West views. Alexander Dugin is described in the West as one of the Kremlin's ideological masterminds, but is considered a marginal figure in Russia. Well, I talked to our correspondent, and Marina Kornova told us more about the circumstances surrounding the suspected bomb attack killing Daria Dugina.
At 6 o'clock yesterday evening, Alexander Dugin gave a lecture, Traditions and History, at the Tradition Festival in the village of Zakharova. This is Moscow region, not far away from Kubinka and from other places. His daughter was also there as a guest. At half past 9 o'clock in the evening, Daria left the festival on the car Land Cruiser Prada. The explosive device was planted in the car that belonged to Alexander Dugin, who at the last moment decided to get into another car and followed Daria. The car left for Majaiskaya Highway and the explosion occurred near the village of Bolshie Vizhomye. The bomb went off while the vehicle was moving. After the explosion, the car crashed into a fence and Daria Dugina, who was driving the car, died immediately. Directly behind the Dasha was his father, who saw all this happen before his eyes. He's in the hospital at the moment. and the death of Daria Dugina is sacred. They beat Dugin. They wanted to kill him physically or kill him through the death of his beloved daughter, and the idea that the word and idea continue to be an important and dangerous subject of life.
Russia and the U.S. waging a war of words over chemical weapons. Moscow has dismissed Washington's allegations that it possesses such arms. It says the U.S. is, in fact, the only country not to have eliminated its arsenal. In a statement, the Russian embassy in Washington said that Moscow completely destroyed its stocks of chemical warfare agents in 2017. It says it's been officially confirmed by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. The mission urged the U.S. to stop evading its international obligations to eliminate chemical weapons. The statement was issued in response to claims made by Washington on the second anniversary of Moscow's alleged chemical poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. The Russian embassy also called on the U.S. not to interfere in Russia's internal affairs. The Somali military has ended an al-Shabaab terrorist siege on a hotel in the capital of Mogadishu. The 30-hour crisis came to an end after forces pounded the Hyatt Hotel with heavy weapons late on Saturday to eliminate the gunmen. Al-Shabaab launched a gun and bomb attack on the building Friday. It killed at least 13 civilians, injuring dozens more. Security sources say that the building is yet to be cleared of possible explosives. This is the biggest attack in Mogadishu since Somalia's new government took office in June. Al-Shabaab is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda and controls much of the southern and central part of the country. It's engaged in long-running conflict with the federal governments. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
A hay'at is a social unit and institution that pivots around love for the household of the Prophet. A person who has a question should not think that everything is upside down. No, his question should be asked, and that's all right. The answer should be provided in hay'ats, in centers of knowledge and understanding. This is the meaning and essence of hay'ats. As for dynamism and movement, this means benefiting from art and face-to-face dialogues. The difference between your art and many other forms of art is that you face your audience directly. You speak to your audience, and they communicate their feelings to you. In other words, you are in contact with one another in a reciprocal, direct relationship. This is the dynamism of the hay'ats. Another form of dynamism is forming daste in the streets, where groups of mourners walk in the streets, in the alleys and in the markets. As a talented brother of ours said, the daste for Imam Hussein are in fact a symbol of Imam Hussein's journey from Mecca to Karbala. His was a movement of jihad and a movement on the path of Allah. The next point about hay'ats is the struggle, jihad, for clarification, as I mentioned before.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
So the Hay'at rely on struggle. What does this struggle mean? Jihad or struggle means an effort and endeavor made to confront the enemy. Not every effort is jihad. Many people make an effort. For example, they make scientific and economic efforts, which are good, but they are not an act of jihad. Jihad means an effort that targets the enemy. This is jihad. In Islamic terminology and in Islamic logic, jihad is an action that is taken to confront the enemy. If you do economic work to confront the enemy, it is an act of jihad. If you do scientific research work to confront the enemy, this is an act of jihad. If you speak out and clarify matters to counteract the enemy's temptations, this is an act of jihad. All of these are jihadi acts. So the important point is that we should identify the fields for jihad in every era. This is very important. We should not make a mistake in identifying the enemy. I have frequently given the following example. Some people fall asleep in a trench at the front and wake up after some time. They do not know where the enemy is and where their fellow soldiers are. So they may point their gun at their own friends. Sometimes this happens. Some people do not know what the fields for jihad are. They do not know where they should go, where the enemy is, which way they should look, and what the target should be. This is what is important.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tensions are rising between Turkey and Syria. Ankara has launched airstrikes on military posts in northern Syria, killing several army soldiers and injuring several more. There are now concerns that a military operation in northern Syria by Turkish forces is imminent. Sources say a new cross-border offensive by Turkey looms large. Turkish forces have reportedly used loudspeakers in mosques in border areas close to the Jarablus city to ask people to stay indoors in preparation for the operation. Reports also say numerous Turkish combat drones could be seen flying in the skies over areas in proximity to the frontier. Turkish soldiers are also mobilizing in most of the border towns of Hasaka, Raqqa, and Aleppo provinces. The Turkish president has already hinted at a possible military incursion. On August 8th, Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara's decision to establish a 30-kilometer deep secure line along the country's southern border is final. Ankara says it's going to curb Kurdish militants operating in that area.
They want actually to annex the northern part of Syria. This is an ambition that that Turkey has to regain, to enlarge some territory that it once had. And I think this is not something that is acceptable either to Syria or even to Russia. Russia wants to have good relations with Turkey, but not at this price, I think.
The US-backed Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG, militant group, which is the backbone of SDF, is present there. Ankara says YPG militants are terrorists. Damascus has warned Ankara against violating its sovereignty. Both Iran and Russia, which have been aiding Damascus in its anti-terror campaign, are also against Turkey's possible offensive. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. Back then, Turkish forces launched a cross-border invasion to push YPG militants away. Since 2016, Turkey has launched three military operations inside Syria. When the crisis began on Syria in 2011, Ankara backed militants fighting against the government in Damascus. For years, it provided them with weapons and military support in a bid to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So this is perhaps just a what we sometimes call a red herring, that is something that will distract the observers from what is actually going on. It makes it appear, makes Turkey appear to be reasonable, when in fact they don't have a reasonable agenda at all. They have an unreasonable agenda.
However, there are signs that Turkey may have changed its policy on Syria. Just recently, it was revealed that the Turkish foreign minister had a brief conversation with his Syrian counterpart last October. The top Turkish diplomat has stressed that there needs to be a reconciliation between opposition groups and the Damascus government. There are reports that Ankara was evaluating the possibility of starting talks with the Syrian government. The leader of Turkey's Nationalist Movement Party has also supported comments to mend relations with neighboring Syria. Turkey now appears to be in a difficult position. The country's economy is now in its worst situation in decades. It's spending nearly $2 billion in northern Syria annually. And sentiments against Syrian refugees in Turkey are rising. That could potentially cost Erdogan his political career. In order to fix it, Erdogan needs to establish relations with Syria.
I think it's going to be a major problem. The attacks, the Turkish attack, indicates that they are not going to accept a reasonable compromise and to respect the territorial integrity of Syria. So this is going to be a major problem.
But at the same time, Ankara does not want to lose Syria card with regards to anti-Assad militants. However, its possible military adventure in northern Syria could trigger another catastrophe in a country which is in the midst of a prolonged crisis.
Tensions are once again heating up between France and its former colony, Mali. The African nation has accused the European country of violating its territorial integrity and arming terrorists. Malian Foreign Ministry has written a letter to the head of the United Nations Security Council urging the body to punish France over its interventionist policies in Mali. We have several pieces of evidence that these flagrant violations of Malian airspace were used by France to collect intelligence for terrorist groups operating in the Sahel and to drop arms and ammunition to them. Mali has called on the UN Security Council to ensure that France, quote, immediately ceases its acts of aggression. Mali has cited an attack on Tessit camp as evidence of the meddling of France in the African nation.
As to what gains France will have from arming the terrorist groups and operating across Mali, in northern Mali specifically, I think the French are very angry because they have been kicked out of Mali by the Malian authorities And they are about to finish their evacuation, military bases evacuation from the country, if they have not finished already.
Molly says after the attack, which claimed the lives of 42 soldiers, quote, clandestine and uncoordinated overflight operations were conducted. Molly also says it reserves the right to use self-defense in the face of measures that undermine the stability of the African nation. France has, however, rejected the allegation, saying it's actually fighting the terrorists.
Essentially, the problem here is the French want to cling to the West African country in Mali and across the region, the Sahel region, for as long as possible. This is their traditional sphere for influence, and they would prefer to stay there.
The latest spat between Mali and France follows a barrage of accusations and counter-accusations between the two nations. France has apparently completed the withdrawal of its forces from Mali. The withdrawal has ended a 9-year operation in the country. France began its mission in Mali in 2013. The operation was aimed at eradicating militants that Paris claimed were linked to the Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France deployed thousands of troops to purportedly prevent separatist forces from reaching Bamako. But the war proved disastrous for Mali and its people. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. Anti-France sentiments are running high among Malians amid the rising civilian death toll. People were long demanding the withdrawal of the troops of their former colonizer.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries.
Mali fell under French colonial rule in 1892, which lasted until 1960. But years after outright colonization, it is still seeking to bring the countries in Africa under its colonial rule. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960. In economic terms, the former French colonies in West Africa are using a common currency that's controlled by the French treasury.
Well, Mali is very important. First of all, it was a French colony. Second of all, the French have maintained some kind of presence, military or otherwise, as well as political and diplomatic influence over the country right after its independence in the 1960s. And from Mali, they could do a lot of surveillance work, intelligence work, and military interference in other countries across the Sahara region, including southern Libya.
Critics say the currency channels more money to France and it strengthens its monetary policy on African nations. In order for that to change, experts say there needs to be a radical change from the past colonial policies.
China has slammed a visit to Taiwan by a group of American legislators, saying it has fully exposed Washington's true face as the spoiler of peace in the strategically sensitive Taiwan Strait. A U.S. congressional delegation, led by Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, arrived in Taipei on Sunday and met with the island's president, Tsai Ing-wen, on an unannounced 2-day visit amid tensions between Beijing and Washington over a recent controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the self-ruled island. In a statement, China's defense ministry said that the U.S. lawmakers' trip is against Beijing's sovereignty and territorial integrity and fully exposes the true face of the United States as a spoiler and spoiler of peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. The ministry also vowed to smash any form of foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the visit, China's defense ministry also carried out more exercises near Taiwan. The military says the exercises are a stern deterrent to the U.S. and its political games undermining regional peace. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said the latest visit is a blatant violation of the One China principle.
China once again urges the U.S. to abide by the One China principle and the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques, handle Taiwan-related issues prudently and properly, and stop going further down the wrong path of hollowing out and distorting the One China principle so as not to cause further damage to China-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The spokesman added that a small number of U.S. politicians are colluding with Taiwan's separatist forces. He said they are unaware of their limits and their efforts are doomed to failure. The visit by Pelosi promoted Beijing to react with an unprecedented burst of military activity, launching its biggest ever military drills around Taiwan. China considers Taiwan to be a breakaway province that should be reunited with the motherland under the internationally recognized One China policy.
What we see is the U.S. trying to provoke tensions where they don't have to. What we have to keep in mind is since 1972, under the Shanghai Communique, the United States government has recognized that there is only one China. Taiwan is part of China. But what we see right now with these tensions being built up is the U.S. trying to manipulate international law and use the idea of American exceptionalism to say that it's trying to help Taiwan and it's not trying to provoke tensions between Taiwan and China.
Tensions between the U.S. and China simmer at a new high since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan earlier this month. Now, the U.S. President's Indo-Pacific coordinator, Kurt Campbell, has revealed that Washington will send aircraft and warships to the Taiwan Strait in the coming weeks, claiming the U.S. expects China to put more pressure on Taipei in the next few months. The senior White House official also stated that Washington is going to announce an ambitious roadmap for trade with Taiwan in the coming days. That's while China claims Taiwan as its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing ties with Washington. Tensions are high, and the bill moving through Congress threatens to overturn Sino-U.S. relations and could prompt a stronger response from Beijing. The Taiwan Policy Act aims to upgrade ties with the island by designating it as a major non-NATO ally. The Taiwan Policy Act of 2022 would also bolster Taiwan's defense capabilities with $4.5 billion in security aid.
I mean, what the U.S. is doing right now is trying to continue to impose U.S. hegemony in Asia, with the U.S. losing hegemony in places like Latin America. It is trying to stay relevant and maintain the relationships that it does have.
It's obvious that the U.S. is only continuing to elevate tensions with China, and Taiwan could end up being caught in the middle of a conflict.
The attack, which occurred just outside one of the gates of the occupied old city of Al-Quds on early Sunday, left at least 9 Israeli settlers injured, 2 of whom are in serious condition. Reports indicate that at least one person ambushed a bus as it arrived at the western wall in the old city. Witnesses say that as people were boarding the bus, they heard gunshots, screams, and warnings that this was an attack. The bus driver has told Israeli media that he tried to pull away, but was unable to do so. Since then, Israeli troops have been raiding homes in a Palestinian neighborhood, and reports have emerged that several suspects were involved and that some were even arrested. Palestinian resistance groups have described the attack as a natural response to the occupying Israeli regime's daily crimes against the Palestinians, calling it a heroic act. The world, however, has remained silent when atrocities against Palestinians occur, which is on a daily basis. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights reports daily killings, detainments, and other Palestinian violations, which is described as a slow death and genocide against Palestinians. But those killings don't even get reported. This attack took place in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli troops have been stationed in large numbers. But doesn't the fact that it took place there mean that Israel is failing to prevent these attacks from occurring?
Well, the first thing to understand in the conflicts that we see developing is that the Israelis, of course, are the responsible party for a lot of the antagonism and the aggression and the attacks that are constantly erupting in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian territories, because they are constantly waging a program of genocide and attempting to remove all ethnic natural inhabitants of the lands and replace them with Israeli settlers. So what the Palestinians and other people do in these areas that are being subjected to forced extermination and relocation is the same thing that any free people would do. If anyone, including myself, was forced to leave my home or evicted or lost loved ones and experienced such a horrific a program of expulsion that the Israelis daily practice, of course people would be responding with any kind of militant response that they possibly could.
Last week, Israel carried out its latest round of aggression against the Palestinian people under the pretext that it was thwarting a terror attack by the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Despite the Israeli atrocity, Palestinians did strike a ceasefire deal with the regime. But the truce is widely believed to be fragile in some sense, as the Palestinians did stop their retaliatory attacks, but Israel has yet to heed their demands. All this, along with the long list of previous Israeli attacks and atrocities against Palestinians, has led to an atmosphere of tension and frustration in the occupied Al-Quds. While the US and Europe condemn the attack, they're encouraging Ukrainians to resist the Russian war, even calling for armed resistance against Russian forces. This shows the double standard approach they have towards Palestinians. But the latest Israeli attack is only one in a long list of the regime's atrocities against the Palestinians on a daily basis. From the destruction of their homes to false imprisonment and the murder of innocent people, including women and children. All this has led to widespread anger among Palestinians whose rights have been violated, leading them to take action themselves. But the question remains, will attacks similar to the bus incident increase since the Israeli violations against Palestinians will continue?
Well, the only way that the crimes against the Palestinians that the Israelis are perpetuating will end, will stop, is when the Israeli government, the Israeli people, rise up and tell their government, we cannot survive the counterattacks any longer. We cannot endure the pain and the suffering that is being inflicted upon us. So we are demanding that the government be overthrown, replaced with new leadership that will honestly and authentically seek out peaceful negotiations of peaceful coexistence that take into account a lot of the crimes and violations of treaties that have occurred in the past, but that are dedicated to moving forward in a positive, mutually agreeable way. So the Israelis and the Israeli people really are the ones that have to suffer and before they recognize that their own government, their own military are perpetuating the suffering of the Israeli people, because the Palestinians are never going to relent. They're never going to stop fighting for their lives, fighting for their children, and fighting for their homes.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, the audience of your very favorite program, For a Better Life. You're listening to IRB English Radio, This is Asma, your friend, and we're going to have a heart-to-heart whisper regarding the literature of Ashura. Previously, we have talked too much about the themes of the literary pieces related to Ashura. Well, we talked about it already, that we have this Islamic literature, and the majority of it is concerned with the story. More precise if we put it this way. The majority of it is concerned with the Battle of Karbala and the tragic story, and let's call it the epic story that happened in there. When we go through different literary texts or pieces regarding Ashura and the Battle of Karbala, we come across too many traits and features related to the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. In the previous episode, we talked about the purity of heart, which is such a very important fact for every human being to maintain. Truthfulness and nobility of the soul, which is achieved by a spiritual connection to Allah. I just remembered the poem by a Persian poet about the spiritual journey of a mystic. He said, "Those who reach the peak and eventually find their way to Allah will melt in His name, just like the butterfly when it loses itself in the flame of the candle and gets burned." Now, great human beings aren't born with the special blessings, or just the way I talked about these mystics. They do not go through too much of special rituals, I don't know, whatever related to these sort of things. Of course, but they aren't alien beings. They just keep their eyes carefully focused on their beloved, that is Allah, and they consider His satisfaction in every step they take in their life. Now, being a mystic or going through too much of drudgery is neither what we learn from the story of Karbala, nor the thing that Imam Hussein alayhi salam wanted us to learn. What we have to learn from Karbala and its tragic epic is to be brave, in addition to all other lessons of that battlefield. When Imam Hussein is going to describe his companions to his sister, he says, "I have tested them. They are the bravest of the tribes. Each of them wants to die for their cause," which is the cause that Imam Hussein alayhi salam has put in front of them. That is the truthfulness toward Allah and siding with the truth. He says that they want to die for this cause like an infant who wants milk from his mother. So as you see in this piece of prose and through all texts that have been passed down to us as poems and prose that we hear every year in the month of Muharram, the main characteristics of the army or the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam is their brave soul. Once they recognize the truth, they stick to it firmly. They never deviate from their imam, or what we call as their leader, to the point that they sacrifice their soul for him with no fear of death. Speaking of valor, I just recalled a beautiful quote from English literature that says, "Cowards die many times before their death. The valiant never taste of death but once." This is the whole idea of life for us as Muslims and as the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, to find the truth and to fight recklessly for it, even if it costs our lives. As you can understand from the whole topic that I opened up in here, We're talking about this very important feature about the men of God, about those who wish to stand with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and make a name of themselves in the history. You know, the great men, great human beings, have this feature very boldly inside of their character. You know, they have this brave soul and they let it grow, you know. This brave soul has to grow and get bigger and bigger as you grow older. Actually, in real life, we can see that as time goes by, maybe, or let's just say, perhaps after some certain cases or situations, we start to be more timid. You know, it's, I guess, I don't know, maybe it's wrong or maybe it's just my personal belief. But I guess as we grow older, we lose that courage to stay brave. We are no longer the valor people who used to be in our teens or in our childhood. It seems that as we grow older, we tend to be more timid, we tend to be more chicken-hearted, and in these situations, it is sort of difficult to speak up and side with the truth. So, just as I talked in previous session, sometimes knowing the truth is very easy. You know, for those people, even perhaps it was very easy to understand that, okay, Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the grandson of the Prophet. His mother and his father are among the best creatures of the world. There is no doubt that he is the right side. He is the truthful person that we should follow and we should side with him. But those people of Kufa who were mostly timid and disloyal, but they could not stand up firmly for the thing they believed in. Maybe if you dig deeper, or maybe if you were a reporter at that age, you would have seen that these people, perhaps they just have never had this intention to do these horrible and horrendous scene happen in the battlefield of Karbala, but they were just timid enough not to speak about it, not to act against it. But usually in the great events of the world in history, we see that people see the truth, but they stay silent.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
We have been created for a greater cause, and life is not going to be something as an immortal blessing or a gift. Eventually, it's going to end, so it's better for us to always pick the right side with a brave soul, considering the very fact that, okay, I'm going to die, so let it be for a great cause. If my imam is asking me to join his army to find the truth and fight for it, I will do it full-heartedly. But for that, I have to just nurture my soul, my entire existence, and let it grow accordingly. Thank you for listening to For a Better Life. This was all the time that we've got for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and it opened up some new windows for you to ponder upon, and maybe it would be just like a flame that would start to burn inside of your mind and make you think more and more about the way you're living, about some new stuffs in your life. Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah bless you.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows. Allah knows.
Midstream.
Have passed since the launch of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah, a memory dear to the heart of every believer in the inevitability of divine victory, and for every believer who dreams of a day free from injustice and oppression in a nation that has nursed injustice and oppression since its early beginnings. With their tender flesh, they resisted, struggled, and persevered. They all came out of small houses from besieged neighborhoods. They saw their families being humiliated at checkpoints, their mothers killed, their fathers' bodies dismembered, their livelihoods stolen at the hands of an enemy wreaking havoc and terror in their country. It was then when the dawn of the resistance broke out in Beirut and South Lebanon. Those few defeated the mightiest of armies, obliging them to retreat towards the so-called occupied strip. Throughout 40 years, their brown hands wove the scarf of freedom to be completed in the year 2000. Victories rolled in until a 2006 victory that shook all corners of the earth. Who are they, those few Arab men who made miracles and defeated the army that was once called the undefeatable army? 40 years of effort, resistance, glory, liberation, dignity, and martyrdom. 40 years of generosity to the homeland and to the ultimate freedom of all the oppressed in the world. Hezbollah, which offered redemption to the Arabs, presented above all the eloquent lesson of victory, how the martyr with pure blood turned everything around him into a force capable of steadfastness and victory. Hezbollah transformed the dirt of betrayal, disappointment, and continuous Arab failure into steadfastness, hope, and victory. 40 years later, Hezbollah became a party that the enemy fears and respects at the same time. A resistance that is keen to reveal, but its silence is a message in itself, which many seek to decipher. 40 years and Hezbollah is rooted in Lebanon, fixed in this country as firmly as its mountains. Its upbringing was not fleeting or devoid of Lebanese history and geographical extension around which a large group of Lebanese gathered, because Hezbollah represented the legitimacy of the resistance to liberate Lebanon, protect it, and contribute to building its state. It is the 40 springs, 40 wisdom, knowledge, patience, morals, and humility. It is 40 strength, power, honor, dignity, and victory. 40 years in which there is no aging, because this party has different, multiplied, interconnected generations always ready to serve the honorable march of Hezbollah. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Forty years have passed since the launch of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah. A memory dear to the heart of believers in the inevitability of divine victory. It might not be an exaggeration to say that in the past century, it has been very rare to find an organization in this region that had such presence, resonance, and influence as much as Hezbollah. It is true that there are entities that passed through this region and had a presence and a transnational influence, but they did not live long in this role due to their lack of ability to reconcile principle and flexibility and their lack of understanding of reality. Hezbollah was able to develop a special model based on its ideological structure, its rich jihadi experience, and the peculiarity of the Lebanese reality. It combined its first identity as a resistance against the Zionist occupation, the American hegemony, and the imperatives of engaging in this Lebanese political spectrum. To discuss this issue, with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament for the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. It's a pleasure always having you with us.